Good to see you back again this afternoon, and we will be looking at Mark chapter 8. I mentioned that this morning, the first 21 verses, maybe a little bit longer than that, but I want to talk about the feeding of the 4,000. I'm impressed. The more I look at the Scriptures, the more I understand about God's Word. Sometimes, you know, you look at the Scriptures and you find... you know, you read through the Gospels and you'll have a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and here's one story and here's another, and you're not really seeing the overall picture of what's going on. And so sometimes it's good to step back and look at things from a broader perspective. And by that, what I mean is each of the Gospels is written to a particular audience. So if you're talking about the book of Matthew, you might keep in mind that the book of Matthew is written to the Jewish reader, and that is explained by the fact that, or seen in the fact that, he spends a good deal of time in the genealogies, which would have been important to the Jew to be able to see that their lineage went through David and all the way to Christ, and that would be important for him to be the Messiah. You'll not find that in the Gospel of Mark. And Mark is what we've been looking at on Sunday nights and examining that. And the reason for that is Mark is written not to Jewish people, but to the Gentiles, in particular the Romans. And so it would be interesting to notice that when you look at the book of Mark, you'll see that Mark just kind of skips over the genealogy and all of that and just gets into just talking about what Jesus did. He's a man of action. Immediately, he would do this and that and the other thing. And so you begin to see that. And you also see it in the fact that Mark took some time to explain to his readers the Jewish customs. A few chapters ago, well, in Mark chapter 7, actually, when he talks about the Pharisees, there's a statement made there that's in parentheses in my Bible. They were talking about why don't your disciples wash their hands? And it didn't mean like we do before you eat, wash your hands and that sort of thing. He meant literally to exercise a Jewish tradition about hand washing that was a religious ordinance, right? And so Jesus, of course, goes into a description there later in the chapter that it's not what is on the outside that defiles a man, is what comes from the inside and that spreads to the outside that defiles a man. Well, Mark takes the time to explain. He says, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. And when they come in from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots." There was a lot of tradition that they had to follow. And so Mark explains that so that the reader, being a Roman, a Gentile, okay, I get it now. They do this sort of thing. But as you look at Mark in particular, in the Gospels as a whole, we might be of the impression that that Jesus, as mentioned in Matthew 15, came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. The gospel came to the Jew first and also to the Greek. We understand that the Apostle Paul, when he went to a city, would begin in the synagogue and talk to the Jews, and then when he was rejected by the Jews, would then go to the Gentiles. And so there's this pattern that it was through the Jews that the gospel came into effect, the lineage of David, and Jesus came through the tribe of Judah and all that. But what Mark points out, and I hadn't realized it so extensively, I guess, or I've forgotten, is that Mark spends more time outside the Jewish realm. He spends a little bit more time talking about things that happened outside of Galilee and Judea, what happened outside to his connection with Gentile people, or people that were most likely, crowds that were most likely predominantly Jews, so that we can begin to see that in Jesus' ministry, he was not just to the Jews. there's a Syrophoenician woman. He goes down to the Decapolis, we'll see in a moment, and preaches there, feeds the 4,000, comes back over to the other side of the sea and confronts the Pharisees, goes back across the other side and back and forth. And if you want to look at the map here, it's hard to find a good map, and so that you can see. And this I took a picture of in the back of one of my commentaries, the Truth for Today commentary. And if you, and I cropped it down and focused in a little bit, so you can see actually a little bit of what we're talking about. Some of the words are cut off, but if you look at the Sea of Galilee, it's to the north of Judea. Normally we think of Jerusalem and Judea. But you go to the north through Samaria, go to Galilee, and this is where Jesus grew up, Nazareth, in fact. And you can see it on the chart there. But you look at this chart, and you'll begin to see that much of what we're looking at in this chapter, let's see if I can get this right. There it is. Can you see that? This Sea of Galilee here, that you'll see events that take place initially all the way up to Tyre and Sidon. And then they come down through to the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, and all the way down to the Decapolis, the 10 cities there. Some maps have the Decapolis going farther north than that, so it's a matter of who you talk to. And then they come across to this side, back over to this side. I mean, back and forth. Capernaum is the hometown or headquarters of Jesus. But near it were several other towns. There was a lot of different places. And as we look at talk about some of these things, you may want to actually look at the map and kind of see it if you can see it. I think it's big enough to actually see this time. So that's maybe an improvement. So let's back up for a moment, get an overall picture of what's going on here. This will take us back a little bit in time. Do you remember the death of John the Baptist? And you remember how that John the Baptist was killed by Herod, and that the news of John the Baptist's death came down to the apostles, or the disciples of John came down and told Jesus. About the same time that the people who had gone on the limited commission came back. Anyway, Jesus says to them all, having heard the reports and all, come, let us go away for a while and rest. And so on that occasion, I think you'd probably see it if I put it over here. On that occasion, they're over here and they decide to rest, and they go across the sea. You see Bethsaida over there. I might just say that there's likely more than one Bethsaida. Some say as many as three, but at least there were two. One over close to Capernaum and one on the other side of the Jordan River. And you can understand why that would be. The name Bethsaida means house of fish, or we call it a fish house. And what did they do around the Sea of Galilee? They fished. There'd be a lot of fish houses. So Bethsaida might have been a name that'd be used more than once. Anyway, they crossed over there. And as they're crossing over for the purpose of rest, you remember what the crowd did? They followed them around. They could see where they were going. And basically, wherever they were around Capernaum, they followed them along the edge of the seashore. And apparently they went off to Bethsaida. And then probably from there, a little bit off, some of the parallel accounts talk about Jesus taking a seat on the mountainside somewhere. So you have some things going on here. Jesus... on that occasion, fed 5,000. 5,000 men, not counting women and children. And so they began with how many fish? Two. And five loaves and two fish. And when they got done, they had how many baskets left over? 12. 12 baskets left over. And everybody had plenty to eat. And as they got through eating, it was getting toward the end of the day, and Jesus sent off the disciples in a boat, if you remember, and they were headed for Bethsaida. Now, that's from one of the other accounts, but it could be that they were down here and they just made a little we're going to make a little jaunt there, or it could be another Bethsaida on the other side they were crossing over to. In any case, they're leaving and they're going on this trip, and Jesus, precipitating the sending away, the disciples, according to John chapter 6, were sent away, and the crowd were intending to make Jesus king by force. Well, putting some words between the lines, I would guess that this may be something Jesus didn't want the disciples to be exposed to. Anyway, sends them across, and he goes up to the, sends the crowd away, goes up to the mountain and prays. And it's probably in the middle of the night, we would say, the third watch of the night. And he sees them struggling in the boat. There's a contrary wind, strong wind, and they weren't getting anywhere. And so Jesus comes to them walking on the water. And as he's approaching, what's their reaction? They were fearful. They were afraid. It's a ghost. And so, if it's you, Lord, Peter said what? Let me come out and I'll walk to you. And he did walk on the water. And that's the amazing thing. He did actually do it. But when he took his eyes off Jesus, because he was looking at the wind of the waves, he began to sink and said, Lord, save me. And out grabbed him and pulled him into the boat, and immediately the waves stopped, the wind stopped, and from that point they went on to Gennesaret. I don't know if that's on this map or not, but Gennesaret would be over in the region of Capernaum. So they went across the sea on that occasion. Now what's interesting here is in Mark 6, 51 and 52, here's what I want you to take note of. He got into the boat with them, and the wind stopped. And they were utterly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. So it's almost like saying, in essence, you just fed 5,000 people from five loaves and two fish, and you are completely blown out of the water by the fact that Jesus calmed the sea, that he walked on water. And when he got in the boat, the waters were, yes, it's an amazing miracle, but so is feeding 5,000 men with five loaves and two fish and having 12 baskets left over. How do you explain that? So he highlights the fact that their hearts were hardened. They hadn't gained insight. I guess I say it that way. So they landed at Gennesaret in Mark chapter 6, 54 through 56. It says, when they got out of the boat, the people recognized him and ran about the whole country and began to carry here and there on their pallets those who were sick to the place where they heard he was. Wherever he entered the villages or cities or countryside, they were laying the sick in the marketplaces and imploring him that if they might just touch the fringe of his cloak, and as many as touched it were being cured. And throughout this whole series, every once in a while, I have a little pocket of information. This is happening, and here's what's going on with the people. And so this is one of those success stories. Now, when we look at the 5,000, and we're comparing it to the 4,000, it's amazing how much parallel thoughts are contained between the two. It's not just one event. It's two events, but there's some similarities and some differences, which we'll get to in a moment. One of the similarities is that every time after one of their success stories, they encounter the Pharisees. It's almost as though the Pharisees are so antagonistic toward Jesus that if he has any kind of success, then they're going to be there to try to throw a wet blanket over any kind of success that he might have. And this time, The Mark chapter 7 is the controversy about traditions. And so they're there, and why don't you guys wash the way you're supposed to wash? Why don't you follow the traditions of the elders? And Jesus responds with a parable about, it's not what is on the outside that enters a man, like through the mouth, that defiles a man is what is on the inside in his heart. And he talks about all of the problems that can come from within. And then after that confrontation, in Mark chapter 7, verse 24, that's when Jesus, the scripture says, oops, pushed the wrong one, sorry. The scripture says that he left for Tyre, the region of Tyre and Sidon, up in here in Phoenicia. We talked about the Syrophoenician woman and the healing of her daughter who was possessed by a demon. And the scripture says in Mark 7, 24, Jesus got up and went away from there to the region of Tyre. So sometimes when he's having these things with the Pharisees, you know, he does not waste a lot of time with these people. It's like that's enough. And sometimes we think that anybody who wants to talk about religion is worth talking to, even though they may be completely blind and hard-hearted or whatever. Jesus spoke about the idea sometimes it's better to shake the sand off your sandals or shoes and walk on to somebody who is interested and open-minded. Anyway, in this case, they went up here. And what we have here is a comparison. What were the apostles in the feeding of the 5,000 and the multiplication of the bread and the fish and all of that? He has a conversation, just pulls this out. You know, it's interesting to think about these writers writing by inspiration. How do they decide what events to include or not include and that sort of thing? So you have the feeding of the 5,000. It didn't really affect the apostles. There was rejection from the people during that occasion also, some of them. But immediately he goes over to the Syrophoenician woman, and when he meets them, she's willing to talk about the crumbs of bread that fall from the master's table. Even the dogs get the crumbs. So here, and he says, I have not seen a woman with such faith. Your faith is great, he said. So here's a woman who is outside of the nation of Judah and Israel, and she is understanding the figurative language that Jesus has been using when he talks about the bread of life in John chapter 6 and the bread from heaven and all of that. And many of the people who should have understood that could not understand it. But here's a Gentile woman who is able to understand that. And that's just an interesting little sidelight there. And so he went from there. They left Tyre and went up to Sidon and came down on this side of the Sea of Galilee. When you talk about population and the people, the mix of audience to whom you're talking to, on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, you're getting into primarily the Jewish people, right? The Galileans. Go a little bit farther south in Judea, the Jewish people. And then you have the Samaritans in between. On the eastern side, then you had people who are more of a mixed population, maybe primarily a Gentile population. Now, I realize that when they conquered the land, there were 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan. But you remember, there's a lot of time had passed, and something happened to a lot of those tribes. Remember, 722, the Assyrian captivity took away 10 northern tribes, and that Judea and Benjamin was kind of the same group. They were left to remain there. But so you had a Gentile population over there as Jesus is talking to the people there. So he comes down to the region of Decapolis. You can see that it says Decapo. That's an abbreviation. It's cut off from the page. But Decapolis, 10 cities in that region. Some of this, just a little bit to the north, would be modern-day Jordan and that sort of thing. But look at the Decapolis here, and you think, well, Jesus is there, and the first thing that happens is there's a miracle. And in our survey here, we're looking at this. There's two miracles, and I want you to put them in your mind for a moment, and we'll come back to them later. But this miracle we've already talked about, here's a man who is deaf. And Jesus gives him hearing back. He heals his deafness. He was also mute. Jesus heals that as well. And then in Mark 7, verse 37, there's one of those little capsule statements of success. And it is said here, they were utterly astonished. He has done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. This is before the feeding of the 4,000. Okay? Highlight deaf to hear. All right? Come back to that. Okay, then it goes on to verses 1 through 3 of chapter 8. He says, in those days, there was again a large crowd, and they had nothing to eat. Jesus called his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the people. Both the 5,000 and the 4,000 mention Christ's compassion for the people. One of them, he proceeded to teach them many things and later to provide food. The other one, he's been teaching for several days and then he provides food. Jesus cares about the whole person. I feel compassion for the people because they have remained with me 3 days and nothing to eat. And I don't want to send them away hungry to their homes. They will faint on the way, and some of them have come from great distances. Okay, Jesus is compassionate. And here's something interesting Jesus did. He presents the problem to the 12. Here's the problem. The people are hungry. They've come from a long distance. If they go away without eating, they might faint on the way. Here's the problem. What are you going to do about it? Well, they'd probably argue about it. But you think that if they had already witnessed Jesus feeding the 5,000, they would have known the answer to that question. But so they kind of fail in that respect. And so they basically said, and this would be, I don't know what verse it says, where will we be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to feed these people? Now, there were cities around, but not a very populated area. And you're talking about quite a few people hanging around and needing food. Where do you look for the solution? I think it's interesting that some of the translation says, where will we be able to find enough bread? And again, you're getting back to the idea of bread again. Where are we going to do it? The question is wrong. It shouldn't have been, where will we find enough bread? But the question should have turned to Jesus himself, because he can provide bread. And so they were looking for the solution in the wrong places. So Jesus says, kind of like he did with the 5,000, how many loaves do you have? They took count 7. Plus there were a few small fish, right? Interesting point here. He gave thanks. First of all, he ordered the people to sit down on the ground. And so they got ready. And Jesus then took the loaves and began, first blessed it and broke it and distributed it to the apostles and they to the people, just like they did in the feeding of the 5,000. So he blesses it. And then he turns around and blesses also the few small fish. You ever notice the fact that he gave two prayers for one meal? Isn't that interesting? And Mark writing to Gentiles, they may never have thought about praying before a meal. I don't know. But he's praying first for the bread, then for the fish. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the Lord's Supper, you know. Here's the unleavened bread. We offer a prayer. We give thanks for it. Here's the fruit of the vine. We offer a prayer. We give thanks for it. And so it's kind of a similarity that's kind of interesting to me. And so when they got done, they had how many baskets left over? 7, right? Baskets of pieces. It may have been bread, it may have been fish, may have been both mixed together. The fish, by the way, it might have been sardines. Something probably salted to preserve it, you know, out there in the heat, you know. Ew. But anyway, you have the fish and the bread, and well, you got seven baskets left over, versus 12 baskets left over. But the word for basket here is different than the word concerning the 5,000. This is a word for a big, large basket. It's like a hamper. The same word is used to describe what happened to the Apostle Paul when he was called Saul, and he got out of Damascus to get away from the people. It's really a hamper made of ropes. And so you get in it, and it's sturdy enough to be lowered outside the wall to the ground. Say, well, you know, that might have been harder for, you know, Paul was small. He wasn't a big guy, maybe. I don't know. But it would be interesting to be let down. Here we're going to try it with Glenn. Over the wall he goes, and the bottom breaks out, you know. But, you know, that's an interesting story there. So let's talk about some similarities between the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Any of those come to mind right away? There's like a, I don't know, 10 or 12 of them. There's similarities. Yes. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And a few small fish, but yeah. Okay. So similarities. One we mentioned, compassion. The large crowd and both, they're gathered in a desolate place. A small amount of food compared to the people wanting to eat. They're both seated following instruction. They prayed over the food, multiplied the food, distributed the food, and at the end, everyone was satisfied in both cases. And they, both cases, they collected the leftovers. Didn't just leave it laying out on the ground. They collected it. And there's other similarities. There's also some differences. First of all, the number of people fed. 5,000 men versus 4,000. Probably men too, but different places that it was done. The first feeding seemed to have happened the same day. The second feeding may have been after 3 days of teaching, probably not necessarily three 24-hour periods of time. And the differences in the numbers. And that was, Cindy mentioned that a moment ago. There's 5 and 2 and 7 and several small fish. And the leftovers, I don't know, comparatively speaking, actually the 4,000, the feeding of the 4,000 may have had actually more leftovers than the 5,000. Because the word for the 12 baskets is a small basket compared to a large one. Okay? But then Jesus questions the disciples, and the disciples answer him. Some commentaries will talk about this is just the same miracle and has a variation of how it's being told, but the miracle is told twice in the same book. I mean, and Jesus questions the disciples and says, what about the 5,000? What about the 4,000? So it's definitely two different miracles. Why do people think that Jesus could only feed miraculously thousands of people just one time? He'd only do it one time. That's it. How many blind people did he heal? Just one? How many people did he heal them from paralysis or things? No, it was multiple times. But somehow we get in the mind, this could only happen one time. No, it happened twice, as recorded in the scriptures here. So they got fed the 5,000, or they fed the 4,000, and they came over to what's that place called again? It's hard to pronounce. Dalmanutha. It's a good place to be from. Robert, where is it on the map here? Well, it's not on the map. We don't know exactly where it is. Some people think it's over here. It could be over here. But it looks like they crossed back over the Sea of Galilee from the east side to the west side. And the reason I think it's on the west side of the Sea of Galilee is because they soon met the Pharisees there. I don't see the Pharisees traveling clear across the sea to find Jesus. They're probably in that area of that city. It's interesting that when you talk about Bible places, sometimes there are places that we have found. We're talking thousands of years, Old Testament things. And you might have a mound that the archaeologists get in and filter through and get down and find different layers of civilization and find an ancient city. It's something I've never really thought I would like to do. I mean, I like to get dirty and get dirt, but I'm not sure I want to get down that particular about the dirt. But they've discovered along the Sea of Galilee, when it's gone down in recent years, a number of different places along the western side of the Sea of Galilee that actually has stone moorings. There used to be harbors, places to attach your boat, but they're now, or at least for many years, underwater. So one of these could have been that city. But that's really not necessary that we know that for sure. But it's here that Jesus had just had the success over on the other side, feeding the 4,000. And in Mark chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, here come the Pharisees. They came out and began to argue. And that word here is the intensive form, perhaps debating, and with Jesus. And they were seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. You know, the Pharisees did that from time to time. It's interesting. Give us a sign from heaven that we might believe in you. Explanation. Baloney. They could care less if Jesus gave them a sign. They could care less. They wouldn't believe it in the world. At this point, they have already said that when he performed miracles, he was doing it by whose power? Satan's power. Besides that, they had already seen signs from Jesus. In John's gospel, the word sign is used more than in the other gospels, but John wrote and he included seven signs. But he said many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which is not written in this book, but these have been written that you might believe and that believing might have eternal life in his name. So they had seen the signs. Remember what the first sign in the Gospel of John was? Wedding of Cana, turned the water into wine. Amazing, isn't it? But their impression here is that, can you give us some signs from heaven? It might have been a sort of derogatory saying, so far all your signs are from the devil. But can you give us some signs from heaven? Or maybe they meant, can you give us some signs from heaven, some really outstanding signs? I mean, really over-the-top signs, like Moses in the manna in the wilderness, like Elijah, Mount Carmel, the fire from heaven coming down to consume the altar and everything on it. Something like that, something that will just overwhelm us. I don't know. Jesus understood what was in their heart, and here the Bible talks about this. It says, sighing deeply in his spirit. Earlier, there's a word used in one of his miracles that's also sighing deeply. But I think in that case, it was over compassion for the state of the person he was healing. But here it's over, it seems to be, mounting frustration for their unbelief. How could they be this way? And he says, I'm not going to give you any signs. Now, Matthew and Luke, a different perspective, a different record of the same event, have Jesus saying, except for the sign of Jonah. They combine these two together. What was the sign of Jonah? 3 days. And what does that foreshadow? Christ is going to die and be buried. 3 days later, he's going to be raised from the dead. The sign he was giving is his resurrection. And when Jesus rose from the dead, did they believe that sign? No. In fact, Matthew 28 says that they went and talked to Pilate and said, this guy, this deceiver, whatever they called him, he said he was going to rise from the dead, so let's make sure that the tomb is taken care of and all this. And when Jesus rose from the dead, they paid the guards, bribed them, to tell everybody that while they were asleep, the disciples of Jesus took the body of Jesus. Wait a minute. Under penalty of death, they fell asleep, and while they were sleeping, they knew who it was who stole the body, and they stole the body without waking them up. Nonsense. But they refused to believe the sign. And so again, you see that happening in their life. And so after this, it didn't really spend a lot of time there, verses 11 and 12, but then it says that they got back in the boat, and they were headed again, let's say from here back up to there, across the sea. And sometimes the teaching that Jesus did took place on a hillside, sometimes while they're walking along. In this case, he has a captive audience in a boat. Okay? And they start talking. And they were arguing over the fact that they had forgotten to bring bread. They had one loaf. And you can see, they're kind of related to my wife. What's for lunch? What's for supper? What do you want? They're thinking about what's the next meal going to come from. And so instead of trusting Jesus, they begin arguing about why they had forgotten it. I wonder if the conflict with the Pharisees was such that they were, maybe they're upset, maybe they were in a hurry, they just overlooked it and left without it. And Jesus knew what they were saying, but he was giving them orders. He was saying, watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Jesus was talking about what? The teaching, the influence of the Pharisees and Herod. He was trying to protect them spiritually. And they're thinking about, he's talking about leaven, and they're talking about bread, physical bread. We forgot to bring the bread. Who was supposed to bring the bread? And so they're having this miscommunication here. Now notice this. Why do you discuss the fact that we have no bread? They just seen Jesus feed 4,000 people with 7 loaves and a few fish. And they're arguing in the boat about, who forgot the bread? You're getting a feeling that maybe they're not getting it yet? In any case, Jesus goes on to say, do you have a hardened heart? Now listen to this. Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets full of broken pieces you picked up? They said 12. When I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? And they said to him, 7. And he was saying to them, do you not yet understand? Don't you get it? Now the Syrophoenician woman got it. These guys have been through it twice and they still did not get it. And Jesus uses this language, having eyes, but you cannot see. Ears, but you cannot hear. What are the two miracles that surround these events? The healing of a deaf man, and in a few verses later, the healing of a man who was blind. And you think, well, isn't that a coincidence? Or could it be that of all the miracles that may have been performed in those in that situation, and Mark is picking these two out to reinforce the fact that these men are not understanding what's going on. Now, it's good to have other verses like in Matthew that talk about they understood that Jesus was talking about their teaching. The leaven, a little leaven, leavens a whole lump of dough. The teaching of the Pharisees spread through the disciples, could ruin things. Watch out for it. Beware. Pharisees' influence would have been traditions. It might have been some other things, rejection, unbelief, lack of faith, all of that. And he throws in the leaven of Herod, which is a little confusing. But Herod was more interested. Now, listen to this. What did Herod want Jesus to do for him? Yeah, show me. He wanted to see Jesus do a sign. So maybe that fits right in here too. Herod wanted the sensational. He was a worldly, ungodly person. And so either case, he says, don't let that influence you in that way. The question I have before we wrap things up here just a little bit. Do we think it's strange that the apostles forgot what Jesus did so quickly? It seems like first of all, it's almost like they were you even there? How come Jesus didn't lose his temper and throw him off the boat, you know? Were you even there? Did you not see what happened? This does not teach you something about putting your faith and trust in me, right? And then you think about, okay, it seems to be human nature to some extent to have short memories. Remember the Israelites? 10 powerful plagues delivered out of Egypt, crossed through the Red Sea on dry ground. Within a few days, they were complaining, we don't have any water. We don't have any food. And we don't have time to get into this now, but several places talks about, are you going to set up a table to feed all these people in the wilderness? And God brought the manna from heaven and brought the quail in, took care of them all the way through the wilderness, but they still were continually forgetting how often they forgot what God could do for them. Yeah, repeat the same thing over and over. And that could be on any number of things, issues. But then as adults, when we're trying to learn a spiritual lesson, that's not like make your bed, take out the trash, but it's like trust Jesus. What he's done before, he can do again. He took care of you back then, he'll take care of you now. Sometimes in our lives, we forget. God, in his providence, has taken care of us. He saved us from our sins. Difficult times have come. He's seen us through it in answering our prayers. He's got us beyond that and beyond that. And then something happens, and it's like we forgot everything that we had happened before. And we go, why? Well, our faith needs to continue and persist. And maybe there's a lesson for us. Remember when Peter got in the boat, one of the things that Matthew says about that is Jesus rebuked him saying, you have little faith. I think that's a sad statement, but a little faith is better than no faith, right? And it's better than a dead faith, James talks about. And then you might think about this possibility, that if you have a little faith, God can use that. He can grow that. And one of the miracles that sometimes gives us trouble is the one that's coming up that we're not going to be able to talk about tonight, but the one where this man was healed of blindness in two stages. First, he could see men walking around like trees. And then he did something else and he could see perfectly after that. And maybe there's an indication here that with a little faith, God can take it and make a bigger faith. So the question then would be, do you have a little faith? When it comes to times when you need help from the Lord, do you have a little faith? Just remember, God can take that little faith, the faith even the size of a mustard seed, and do great things with it in our lives. But we have to have that little faith to start with. Might be this evening if you need help with prayers. We can assist you in any way. We're going to sing this song of invitation and invite you to respond if you need to by coming to the front while we stand and sing.